From the Danker Studio on Library Square, this is The Rundown, an exploration of local news, current events, and issues that matter to you. Today on the program, we'll be having a conversation with Design Build Bluff founder Hank Lewis about that organization's work with architectural students to build sustainable homes for members of the Navajo Nation in southern Utah.
And it's interesting to watch the students who come from, kind of this white bread valley, go down to the reservation and understand that really we're living on the edge of a third world country. I mean, the conditions are that bleak for housing.
That conversation and a look at Governor Gary Herbert's new water advisory board, just ahead on The Rundown here on KCPW. And thanks again for tuning into The Rundown this afternoon. I'm Roger McDonough. Coming up later, we're going to have a discussion about a hands-on university architectural program that works on the Navajo Nation. But first up, Utah is the second driest state in the country, and we use about 40% more water per person than neighboring states like Arizona, Colorado, and New Mexico. With the climate changing and the population growing, water won't stretch as far in the future as it has in the past. To try to tackle this issue, Governor Gary Herbert has asked a team of advisors to come up with a 50-year water strategy for the state that will include reducing consumption by 25% by 2025. Reporter Kim Shusky of Explore Utah Science has that story.
870 billion gallons of water are consumed in Utah each year. It goes to water crops and lawns, to drink, cook, and bathe. For now, Utah has enough water to satiate consumers and maintain plants and animals that rely on streams, lakes, and watersheds. But with an expected increase in temperature and a population set to double by 2060, the future of the state's water is uncertain. Alan Matheson is the state planning coordinator and environmental policy advisor, Governor Herbert.
I think we all recognize that water is going to be one of the key issues for us going forward. As our population grows, as projections of water availability change, those states that are prepared and thinking ahead about water are going to succeed, and those that don't will fail.
Governor Herbert has taken steps to make sure that Utah is one of the states that will be prepared. He has tasked a group of 38 people to come up with a water strategy for the state. They come from different backgrounds, including water management, politics, conservation, agriculture, industry, academia, and there's one representative for Native Americans.
You know, as we looked at putting that team together, we recognized that there are hundreds of people in the state that certainly could participate and contribute meaningfully. And we just had to get to a number that would be workable, and we could manage and actually get something done.
Matheson says the group will gather information, reach out to the public, and explore a range of policy options. At the end of the year, they will develop a set of recommendations for what the state strategy should look like. But getting there won't be easy. The governor's team took a listening tour across the state over the summer, visiting 8 different locations and giving people a chance to voice their water concerns and priorities in person and online. They received 800 comments that illustrate the conflicting opinions around the state about how water should be managed in the future. Here are a few from the Salt Lake City meeting.
Conservation should be the primary solution to our growing water needs rather than resorting to major water projects.
We need every drop of the Colorado River Basin water for drinking and for food production. There is no good reason to fund an oil shale development where the world is already awash in oil.
Conservation with reuse and recycling alone cannot meet the needs of our doubling population. Substantial water supplies need to be developed.
So why does Utah specifically use so much water? One of the main reasons is that Utahns don't in fact pay for water directly. Instead, water in Utah is subsidized or paid for in your property taxes.
Two things. I want to see water in our streams, sufficient water to support a healthy aquatic environment. And I want access to those streams wherever they are so ordinary citizens like me can enjoy recreation on them.
Kentucky bluegrass probably belongs in Kentucky.
Utah farmers and ranchers are producing just over $1.3 billion each year in farm gate sales, contributing $15 billion in Utah economic activity.
Steve Erickson is a conservationist with the Great Basin Water Network and a member of the Water Advisory Team.
It's going to be testy and contentious, I'm sure. Hopefully we can all cooperate and try to arrive at some compromises that will be required. There likely will be some folks who will want to draw lines in the sand, and that remains to be seen how that'll play out. The issues of water are always difficult. There's not going to be a simple answer to any of this.
Erickson says he personally is trying to set aside some of his biases in order to work towards a compromise, but sees his role as a liaison for others in the conservation community, so their concerns get addressed and their suggestions get reviewed.
We're going to have to determine a means to protect the environment, to value water in place for the environment itself. Currently, under the way that Western water law is structured, the environment doesn't have a water right.
Water rights are allocated based on providing a beneficial use. And under current law, leaving water in place to benefit the environment is not one of those uses. If the laws were changed to legally provide rights for the environment, that could leave fewer rights for other uses such as agriculture, which currently uses 80% of the water in Utah. This is just one of many contentious issues that the team will have to navigate. Water conservation, the likely need for developing new water projects, and changing how water is priced will all be a part of the discussion, says Matheson.
And we really have, I think, a stewardship duty to those that follow to make sure that we're not breaking the bank and committing ourselves to significant infrastructure projects, and we're not drying up our streams. And that's a tough balance, but it's something that we simply have to do.
Water is just one of many issues facing the state. Others include air quality, transportation, energy, and jobs. Matheson says all of these issues are part of an umbrella process called Your Utah, Your Future. Each issue will be studied individually and collectively with the difficult goal of maintaining Utah's economic health while also preserving a high quality of life for people in the state. For KCPW and Explore Utah Science, I'm Kim Shusky.
In the coming year, Explore Utah Science will be producing a five-part series on research efforts dedicated to maintaining and improving water sustainability in Utah. The series is made possible with support from iUtah, a National Science Foundation-funded statewide research consortium. I'm Roger McDonough, and you're listening to The Rundown. Stay tuned. Today on The Rundown, we have Hank Lewis, adjunct professor at the University of Utah's College of Architecture and Planning, and founder of Design Build Bluff, a Park City-based nonprofit organization that gives architecture students the chance to design and build a new home for a Navajo family in Bluff, Utah. They do this with a focus on sustainability and respect to the unique social, cultural, and environmental needs of the region. Hank, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you. It's nice to be here.
So let's start by delving into the concept behind Design Build Bluff, or DBB. Can you tell me a bit about its origins and its mission?
Yeah, I think the mission really starts with the students and starts with the education. In the mid-90s, when the computer was really taking over design, it originally started to help drafting issues, but then crept into design. And I felt like students were losing any sort of tactile sense to what a project might be. And so we began it really thinking that students with the think-make idea, because you need to use your hands involved in education, I think. Once you get totally into the brain, then everything becomes relatively abstract. So this was meant to be a real project, meant to get students out in the field understanding what goes on as in a built environment. Another part of Design Build Bluff is to show the students that, you know, a piece of architecture doesn't just involve one brain, one man, one architect, one starchitect. So there are designers and firms, and then there are the other group that actually puts the building together. And that's what Design Build Bluff intends to do, is show how many things there are that go into a built piece of work.
You know, I'm curious about the some of the nuts and bolts there. What is the cost of building the house? And, you know, I'm wondering if the students are doing all of the work when they do that.
The students are doing all the work. As far as electrical, mechanical issues, plumbing issues, we have a licensed electrician or plumber on site who also wants to teach. I mean, the real burden, you understand, is when you get out on you know, on site to find a contractor. We also have a contractor who is interested in teaching students, a contractor who is interested in changing the whole dynamic of contractors versus architects. So we want to meld that whole thing back together and have it be a pleasant experience. At first, an architect and a contractor were the same person long ago, and they've since diverged, and now contractors say architects don't know anything about building, and they're right. So that's what we're trying to change that scenario.
You know, so on the Design Build Bluff website, it states that more than 2.4 million Native Americans live on or near tribal land. They face some of the worst housing conditions in our country. Over 40% live in overcrowded or dilapidated housing. Basic infrastructure, including water, sewer, and roads, are often severely inadequate. Can you tell me a little bit more about that situation? What is what's average housing on the reservation like?
Average housing on the reservation is either non-existent, an old hogan that has to be recreated every 20 years or so, which isn't terrible, but or a trailer, a dilapidated trailer, or a trailer that has no sense, that has just been dropped on the landscape with no sense of orientation or anything like that. It's bleak, and it's interesting to watch the students who come from, you know, kind of this white bread valley go down to the reservation and understand that really we're living on the edge of a third world country. I mean, the conditions are that bleak for housing. And, you know, who knows why that is? I mean, there are a bunch of interesting possibilities. Because, one, the Navajo, at least, they like to live far away from one another, separate. So they have the clans. And that's difficult for building, because for infrastructure, because the electric companies, power companies, don't really want to, you know, send 10 miles of line out to one family.
Right.
So that makes it a little bit more difficult. And we'll see whether they congregate more or not. I doubt whether they will.
I'm thinking about that would be the culture adapting. But part of what Design Build Bluff does is adapt what they build, you know, for the culture that is there. Maybe you could talk about how Design Build Bluff, you know, works with the Navajo to try and adapt their designs to fit the culture of the Navajo people.
We talk to them. We try to bring the students down as soon as possible, down to the bluff, down to the area, down to the reservation, to talk to the families, to begin to understand what the culture is. We'll have Navajo at the university come speak to us to begin to understand the culture and what needs to happen in a house. The hogan is set up in various ways to reflect the religion, reflect the male and the masculine and feminine ideas, reflect the colors of the different cardinal points. The procession is clockwise, actually, around the hogan. It's funny. There are a lot of very interesting stories that we have. At first, one time we were asking Rosie Joe, who was our very first client, asking her about the program, and we were leading it. You know, we've since learned that. We led the discussion, and we'd say, well, you want three bedrooms, right? And she would just nod. Of course, she's getting a house for nothing, right? Mm-hmm. So she would nod, sure, yes. And then we go back, and we see that they've taken all the beds and put them in one room. So we come back and remodel the house and to make it make sense for their culture. So that's how, you know, that, by doing, the whole idea is to be doing. You know, I see and I hear and I understand, you know, I see and that sort of thing. But I do and I understand. That's the old Chinese proverb.
Yeah.
So by doing things, we look at that, and that's the way we learn about situations. We used to think, oh, everything's got to be so open. It's such a beautiful landscape. We got, you know, the views are phenomenal. And we come back, and all the windows will be covered with Navajo rugs. because they don't want the skinwalkers looking in.
Oh, well.
A sort of mysterious idea about skinwalkers walking around in the night. We try our best to adapt what we're doing, the students' interests are, which is great. They're interested in sustainable building. So there, you don't really have to spend much time convincing them that's the way of the future, because it's obvious. And, you know, the sites that we get beg for something like that, beg for innovative thinking about really the orientation and materials are 80% of the game.
What are those innovations that Design Build Bluff brings to housing there?
Well, I like to say innovations, but we use Trom walls. We'll use them in different ways. It's experimental. So that's what's great about building on the Navajo Reservation. You don't really have building officials breathing down your necks all the time. So you can try something, and if it doesn't quite work, you can tear it down and try it again. You don't have a lot of official oversight. We build the code. I mean, we're not going to go out there and not build the code and not pay attention to things. But it's mostly thermal mass and how you situate a building on the landscape to take advantage of the great solar aspect of the area. I mean, there's sun beating on you all the time. And in fact, cooling is really the biggest issue down there. It's at 5,000 feet, so it's freezing cold when we're building. We start in January, and it's interesting to see the students, how their minds sort of change as the seasons go on and as the temperature changes. And they begin to think more about cooling after probably 6 weeks. And so that's the deal. And you have to set up the house so it has natural ventilation. I mean, that's a big part of it. That helps cooling quite a bit.
Right.
And using the thermal masses that in the diurnal shift from day and night, you'll use actually a big thermal mass to be on the ground and cool during the evening, and then it will radiate cooling during the day.
Jumping back to what you were saying about the culture being dispersed and sometimes having difficulty accessing utilities, are the houses that you're building connected to the grid, or are they off of it?
They are. What happens is we interview families, different families, and a family comes with a site. They have a home site lease, which is 1 square acre, and they've already chosen it. That's one thing. That's one of the prerequisites for a family to get a house, is to have that already in place. That takes them about 3 years to get the home site lease through the Navajo tribal government. So once the students will select a family that comes with a certain site, and that site might have electricity already, might have water. Likely, I'd say it's about 30% likely that it'll have both, and maybe 50% likely that it'll have one or the other. So if it doesn't have electricity, sure, we have to think about how the solar panels will work with the house. We don't really want to just stick them out as an afterthought. So they have to be incorporated into the building, the design of the house. Water, we have water catchment systems. So we will try to catch as much water as possible. And on the Navajo Reservation, it's only there's about 9 inches of rain a year. So you have to be careful to, you know, collect it when you can. And there are certain seasons when it rains more. And the filtration of that water is a technical issue that the students can't be involved with that. We have to have professionals do that.
Mm. And so is all of the water for a given site, does that come from catchment? I mean, from collecting the water, or is it are there, you know, pipe systems as well?
We begin to think about it in water. We'll certainly always catch water.
Yeah.
And if it's a really great question, because if the family is relegated to just using water catchment, they can, because they're used to having no water. They're used to the way the system works is there's a guy who has a pickup truck with a big tank in it, and he goes and fills up from a seep coming out of the rock somewhere, right? And that's actually sort of the community center where the seep is, because you'll meet everybody there. They fill up these tanks, and then they'll drive around to their different clan members and fill up tanks at the house. So they're used to it, and they can live that way. But if there is water, if there's a water system coming to the house, they use more of it. It's interesting. Yeah.
Hey, I'm wondering, you know, you said earlier on that the students take for granted the idea that, you know, sustainable techniques, the green building techniques are, you know, what they're going to be doing. But has that been the case throughout your whole experience with Design Build Bluff? With DBB, I guess I should call it.
No, it's growing. It's okay. Definitely growing. And we find as things move through, there are – at the beginning, I think the mentality was mostly service oriented, and so that's begun to kind of meld with environmental thinking. So students will come. It's not difficult to get students to come to Design Build Bluff. I mean, we're having kids from all over the world coming, so they come for those two reasons mostly. And not necessarily to understand building systems, and it's great to see how they react to having to build something themselves. Hmm. And the learning that you see from day one to the final day, phenomenal. I mean, we'll have kids who've never used a skill saw before in their lives, never even hammered a nail, honestly.
Do you think you're in addition to giving people those hands-on skills, do you think you're the part of the point is to instill the sort of social responsibility, the idea that they're contributing to something greater and maybe taking that forward into their career?
Absolutely, yeah, without question, that's very important. Housing people might be one of our larger problems we face, I think, in the future. People need housing, and I don't even know the number of, you know, you mentioned what, 2.4 million Native Americans. I mean, I can't even imagine how many people there are without housing throughout our country, and architects tend to not think about that. Hmm. Architects are thinking about building, you know, about the urban environment, about how, you know, how much, you know, it's an economic situation that they're looking for clients. And I think the more people come out of these design build bluff type programs, the better they're going to be prepared to think about providing housing for the people that need it.
Can I ask how many of these houses you've built so far?
Well, I think we're just passing 20. The program itself is maybe, I think it'll be 15 years next year. And it started doing some smaller projects around Park City and Salt Lake City for 2 or 3 years until we had to prove ourselves, and rightly so, to the university before they're going to let 20 kids go down to Bluff. Sure. And you know, for a whole semester, you know, out of control, and it's, you know, it's nerve wracking for risk management thinking. It is.
Where are the students housed when they're down there?
We have a mini campus. It's called the Score Up House. It's a great old sandstone home built by a guy named Al Scorup, who is a big rancher. It was built in 1905. And he had six daughters. So originally we bought that property thinking that that house would be enough. You know, it housed eight people. So we originally went down with just eight people. And now it's grown. We can house 22 people. We've had different semesters where we were able to build more infrastructure on our own property. It's about a 5-acre piece of property in Bluff.
I'm curious if these sustainable building techniques are incorporated in the average architecture curriculum. And I guess I'm asking because passive solar is a great design, but you don't see it that often in like developments.
That's true. And that's true. I mean, yes, more and more sustainable practices are becoming part of the curriculum in architecture. Certainly. No question about it. It's you know, in order to survive as a species, I think we're going to have to be thinking about that. Once a student becomes an intern architect in a firm, yeah, it's difficult. There aren't you would hope that soon developers will understand this too, and maybe architects will be able to insinuate themselves into that discussion beforehand. That's what we're hoping, and I think that will be possible. Unfortunately, it's taking longer than we need. Absolutely, there are more and more teachers, more and more faculty members who are the sustainable issues, and passive solar, like I said earlier, is probably 80% of the way, and then it becomes sort of high tech stuff to get 100% net zero. But you can get 80% there with just having a thought about the way something is oriented.
I'm wondering if what the future holds for design build bluff. Are you guys still plan on doing this? Is it basically once a season that you do it? I mean, once a year.
We have the University of Colorado Denver. They've been working with us for 4 or 5 years now, and they design in the summer, build in the fall. The students at the University of Utah design in the fall and build in the spring. Hmm. So we've been doing two houses a year. And in my opinion, we got to keep the mini campus down there rolling all the time, just for an economic concern. At first we noticed that we were leaving that place for 8 months just to sit. So we may get more universities involved. That was my take on it. Now that we've actually moved Design Build Bluff, it's the nonprofit. It used to stand alone. Now it's part of the university. So it's going to be more institutionalized, which has a lot of pros. It might have some cons, but we'll see.
You mentioned earlier that the students pick the clients. How does that part work?
We've learned over the years. We first went down and I thought it would be a good idea to ask the businesses in Bluff to recommend their employees. And then we interviewed those employees, and the students will select somebody who they think might be best impacted by having a new home. As we've gone on, we've learned that the Utah Navajo Trust Fund, which I think is now the Utah Royalty Fund, something like that, it's a guy named Tony Daish. He has lists of people who need homes for all of the Utah Strip of the Navajo Reservation. So we thought, why should we be bouncing around trying to make our own list? And he has a list of, hundreds of people who need homes. And he'll help us out to filter the people who he thinks will be able to live in a piece of architecture. What the students build is a piece of architecture. You were hinting at it before with your idea about how will sustainability come into our development schemes of the future, right? It's a little bit of a dance because some of the Navajo, I think their ideal situation would be to have a double wide trailer because that's what's been happening. They'll bring double wides or single wides, and everybody wants a double wide. So they want a double wide trailer, a lot of people, and we can't provide them a double wide trailer, which is an interesting paradox, right? Because we're trying to build a piece of architecture. And so somebody has to be able to live in a piece of architecture.
And the demand, what's become the appreciated thing, is not a piece of architecture, but a trailer that's provided by basically the government.
Right. But there are many individuals who want what we do. So that's how Tony Daish filters the thing out. And that's another thing that we originally were interviewing the families about. How can we see whether they can live in what we're going to build? Which is unfortunate because the neediest of the Navajo are never selected by the students because the communication is impossible. We have to be relatively far away from somebody who is a super traditional Navajo and living in dilapidated hogans with no heating or anything like that. They have to have a translator. We have to stand very far apart. And so there's no real connection between the two. And so that's another part of the cultures coming together and students learning a lot from the Navajo and the Navajo learning a lot from the students.
For people who aren't students, are there opportunities to learn more or maybe to tour these houses?
Yeah. It's changing because of this institutional bureaucracy that we're now a part of, and I think that'll be fine. There are going to be certain dates that we can publish on the website where there will be tours. Previously, if people show up, you can just show up and bluff. You can find us, no problem. Everybody knows where we are. It's just Bluff's a 250 person town. You can show up. Previously, you could show up, and we would have one of the students go tour you around. That way, the students are even learning more. They're learning how to communicate about what's going on. So that was always fun because we'd have a different student doing it every time. The idea is that there's learning going on all the time. I mean, there's learning even as we cook. The students cook dinners in rotation, so they get competitive about that. And they want to outdo the person who cooked the dinner last night. So it's all pretty great. And we live together, and there are again issues with that, with everybody living together, working together. You can't go back to the house without somebody asking you a question about some detail. They're always sketching details all night long and all morning long. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's real immersion in...
Total immersion. That's the word.
And I'm sure that there's lifelong friendships that are, developed in these... it's like an exchange program almost.
Students will go and spend a weekend at the houses that they've built with the families.
Wow.
I mean, they become part of that family.
Wow. Well, Hank Lewis, adjunct professor at the University of Utah's College of Architecture and Planning and founder of Design Build Bluff, I want to thank you for coming in and speaking with us today.
Well, thank you. I hope this is useful, and I hope people will come visit and will see what we're doing.
And if they want to learn more, can they go to a website?
They can go to the website. It's the W's and then designbuildbluff.org.
Great. And that's all the time we have for the rundown this afternoon. Our show was produced by Lauren Colucci. We also had help from Jesse Ellis and Mr. Tyler Ford. Our theme music was composed by Tim Myers. Tomorrow on the program, tune in for a conversation with Salt Lake County Mayor Ben McAdams about his proposed budget. Roger McDonough, thanks for joining us today. Stay tuned for the Utah Business Report and Marketplace.